Welcome, everyone, to Healing of Agape this week. Today we have with us Dr. Peter Moskow, who is the president, is it the National Society or the International Society of Radionics, Peter?
It's actually the United States Psychotronics Association.
Psychotronics.
Yes.
It's sorry about that. It's
a national group with international membership as well.
So what do you do there, Peter?
Well, essentially, it's an educational forum that was put together back about 32, 33 years ago. In its first meeting, it was actually the United States Radionics Association. And then the term was changed to represent a slightly broader range of interests. But that's, you know, a small detail because it still incorporates education about radionics and all the related sciences connected to that.
So, and let me just say this, ask you this. You're a scientist, you're a researcher, right? So what you're going to tell us today is fact, not something that you think.
No, we'll try to remain sort of objective about it. Our group, the Psychotronics Association, is purely, it's a 501c3 all sort of volunteer organization. So It's designed to present educational materials to the public. Our aim is to look at the scientific aspects of the paranormal as opposed to the merely experiential aspects. And in my private work, I have my own corporation, which has been around in Kentucky since 1980, and we do a lot of consulting and research-type work and also do private work for clients.
Tell us, for my listeners that don't know, exactly what is radionics?
Radionics is a term that developed, largely speaking, from the time of Dr. Albert Abrams, who was a physician on the West Coast, came out of the San Francisco area, young man, very brilliant, qualified, super early in life, and went on into study with some of the top names in Europe. Came back to the States, became a professor at Stanford University, and developed a remarkable sort of insights and left textbooks on the subject of percussion. And if you remember, percussion is that business where the doctor comes along and he takes a couple of fingers and he taps your stomach or your chest or your back, you know, to check your lungs to see what kind of sounds exist to tell what's going on inside. And Abrams was remarkably adept at this and was really one of the leading lights of his time, and I think his textbooks are still acknowledged as being very important. From that work, he actually went on to discover that the sounds in the body that he was tapping were sometimes affected by the position that the person was standing in, and also by whatever disease they were suffering from. And he eventually figured out that different diseases affected the inside or the tissues, the tone of the tissues, in various ways. It's a fascinating story, but he eventually developed equipment which was able to measure the differences between these, what he thought of as radiational aspects of the disease. And these instruments came to be known ultimately as radionic instruments, combining the idea of radio, in the sense of radiation, rather, sending out waves of information, and also linking it to, ultimately, the consciousness of the mind of the operator, or the neurophysiology of the operator, who was able to detect these very subtle differences in the radiational qualities of a disease, one from another. And thus he brought, in a sense, at a fairly early point in the century, he brought brought sort of physics and medicine together in a fairly, I would say, crude way, but a very important way. And there's been a whole branch of medicine that has developed out of that thinking. And it's been fascinating, well, close to 100 years now.
Now, consciousness happens to be my passion, so now I have to ask this question. How does, I got to think of how to word this. How does consciousness tie into this equipment that you're using?
Well, the ability of anybody's mind to focus attention is very important. That's the first part of it. And that, of course, involves, loosely speaking, what we call consciousness. Not an easy term to define in
Yeah, you're going to have to do that in just a minute, by the way.
Yes. Well,
give me that definition.
I'll have to do something to do with that. But I think most of us understand vaguely anyway, if not precisely, what we mean by the word consciousness, which realistically is the organism or the psyche's awareness of itself, as opposed to just being aware of other things. And it's the combination of the awareness of the self and the awareness of other that lends us to speak of consciousness. And combined with that ability is the ability to be creative. So the higher on the scale of awareness and creativity one gets, the more one could say consciousness is involved. Mm-hmm. Quantifying that in terms of intention is not easy, but we all understand the difference between I intend to do something and I didn't intend to do it, but it happened anyway. Mm-hmm. And so intentionality comes into this discussion very strongly. Now, when the mind is focused, one of the things we know that happens is that energy is directed, and we know one of the things is that it's directed through the brain into, for example, the arms and the hands, so mm-hmm. much so that a dowser, somebody who's using, let's say, an L-rod or a witch hazel stick or a pendulum, would get a reaction coming from his or her brain using a questioning and answer process. So everybody knows of water witching. People have usually heard of it or seen it happen. Nobody can easily describe the mechanism, but what we can say is that whenever a signal is detected of some kind underground from, say, a water supply, there's a reaction in the mind and brain of the person seeking it, which generates a signal coming down the arm into the fingers, which moves the pendulum in a subconscious or non-automatic way, mm-hmm. in the sense mm-hmm. that it's not something, well, it is automatic in the sense that you don't have any control over it, but it's not like a machine in that it's not turned on automatically. The consciousness of the individual must be directed in some sense to finding the object, namely the water supply. So people who are able to do this experience a change in the way that the stick operates. It will suddenly twist, for example, very powerfully, or the pendulum will move very suddenly. Mm-hmm. And then there are other devices that can do the same thing. So in that way, the mind or brain of the operator interacts with the gadget or the machine. And it's presumed to be that way because of constant empirical feedback. And, of course, as we say, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. So getting a consistently good result means that you have to practice until you're sick of practicing, and you keep repeating the practice until you get more and more accuracy with it. But in that sense, mind and matter interact. And that's what the study of psychotronics is about.
You brought up a couple of questions. One reason I wanted to interview you is because I'm working on this project to actually try to define the gradients of consciousness, because I found people don't know what consciousness is. I asked a medical doctor one day, standing in the grocery store line with me, what is your definition of consciousness? And he looked at me like I was stupid and said, the opposite of being in a coma. And I said, well, is that all? And he said, well, what else is there? So let me ask you two things before we move forward. Number one, what is your definition of consciousness? And number two, what is your definition of mind, and how does that differ from consciousness and brain? How does it differ from brain?
Well, I would say, simply speaking, that the universe is composed of what I would call units of awareness or consciousness.
Would that be the consciousness atom?
In the old days, esoterically or theosophically, there were people who would point up that, yes, some things were definitely part of that consciousness atomic structure, if you like, a permanent atom, a tiny, tiny, tiny particle that would be somewhat irreducible in size, and that would have been considered like almost like a consciousness unit. I happen to like the Sethian model, which is done by Jane Roberts, in which she talks, or he talks, about two levels of units. One is the electromagnetic unit, which a lot of us could understand fairly easily, something, you know, tinier, obviously, than an electron, but sort of electrical in nature, which is like a primary, very primary kind of particle. And then below that, Seth talks about consciousness units, and it is those units that are awareized, as you would say, that are aware of what they are and who they are and their connection to everything else. I think the difference between something that is conscious and something that is intelligent, in the sense of, you know, machine or artifact, is that awareness is the fact that you have multiple strands of awareness of the universe, which does not require action on your part, but merely the registration of that awareness. And I think that distinguishes almost everything in terms of consciousness. Most of us think in terms of behavior and action, and therefore you can measure consciousness by action. But in fact, it is probably more of an internal measurement of beingness that you can understand and perceive within the self, almost anything that is around you on different levels, different grades. But there is no requirement for you to do anything with it. And in that sense, then a leaf would be considered consciousness, or could have consciousness or awareness. A stone might have that. The tiniest particle in the universe could be aware, even though it might do nothing with it. That's my understanding of awareness and consciousness, that it is more than simply the act of being able to do something, but it is the act of being able to perceive the environment, and also to direct that perception into action. And that comes down to the good old-fashioned question of choice and the activation of will. Very ancient concepts, philosophically and psychologically and spiritually.
Now, what about... excuse me, brain. How does brain differ from mind and consciousness?
Well, the brain is kind of like a gigantic relay terminal that does just about everything you need it to do in order to focus your attention or your awareness in the physical world that you find yourself in. So without the brain, you wouldn't really be able to materialize much in the world as you know it. In fact, very little, if anything. So you need a steering function, and the brain seems to provide it, and the brain also cross-links to the sort of physicality of the issue, because we're using terms that are a bit circular here, but nonetheless, you've got to have something to make the hand move. And very often I'll ask a client, I'll say, when they talk about things and they don't want to go a step beyond, I'll say, well, now that you seem to know, or you understand what you're talking about, or you claim to, tell me something important. and that is, how do you blink your eye? And after a few minutes of discussion, they realized they really can't tell me. Because I don't know anybody who's ever told me how they blink their eye through all the steps. Now, I don't have anybody who's had a problem blinking their eye either.
So do you think that the dowsing and the works through the autonomic nervous system, the brain interpreting consciousness and relaying it to the autonomic nervous system, and then that responding?
Yes.
Is that how it works, do you think?
Yes. I mean, we know from, we're very certain about how the dowsing response operates in the physical aspect. It's not really difficult to study it, because one of the things that was found, and it's quite clear, because I was actually involved in the experiments that did it, we found that at the moment of the time of the stick reaction, using a classical radionic stick plate, which is really no different in essence from using a dowsing stick or a pendulum, just as a slightly different technique. But at that moment, there is an enormous discharge of static electricity, which is measurable.
Interesting.
And it's measurable every single time. And again, I can verify that because I was present, in a study where I was the operator, and we were trying to determine if the gentleman in question who had set up the experiment believed that he had found the radionic signal. Well, actually, what he found was a correlate of it, because that's the best he could find. But at the time, he thought he had, and then he was rather disappointed when he realized that the meter, which was kind of swinging off the clock, was not registering anything super esoteric, but it was registering a large discharge of static electricity at the moment that the signal was detected. And that, of course, is a very good discovery, because you can then, design further experimental work if you have the time and money to go from there.
Is that what HeartMath is registering? Are you familiar with their work?
Yes, in fact.
Is that what that is, that discharge?
Yes. They may be registering some part of it. I mean, there's other aspects to what you can register in the signaling. But what we do know, that when a human mind is tuning itself to detect very precise information, that when the hit is achieved and when it is discharged, so to speak, mm-hmm. when the pendulum moves or the hazel twig turns or the stick plate sticks, at those moments we know that a high charge of static is released through the hands or fingers, particularly through the Pacinian corpuscles in the fingertips, and it's released directly onto the plate and onto the machines. It's measurable as a discharge for a second or two. It's quite a strong thing. You can put a tri-field meter, which we did, onto the radionic device, and that's how we knew it was happening. And it's very important. Talking about HeartMath, one of the scientists who was at HeartMath years ago is one of our board of directors at the USPA. And we have, paradoxically, that's Dr. Glenn Ryan. And Glenn is one of the foremost scientists in the field of subtle energy and its effects on stuff like DNA. Mm-hmm. In fact, where he and I are presenting the results of research at the upcoming USPA conference, which is coming up this coming week. It'll be starting on Friday. And it's in Nevada at the Flamingo Hotel.
And can you share a little bit with us what you found?
Yes, of course. One of the things that we were testing was, and it, in fact, the gentleman, one of the sponsors this year of the USPA, is named Gene Kuntz. Gene created a machine called the Vibe Machine. Some people may have heard of it.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
And in fact, we own one here in our practice in Kentucky. And he has been trying to research the effects of the Vibe, the sort of hard science effects. And so Glenn set up the experiment so that up in New York he was running, he was heating up DNA and then he was zapping it with the Vibe machine, and then watching the sort of unfolding of the DNA and the refolding of it. So
now, did he have to place some intention, or did he just turn it on?
No. He does it with a hardcore measuring system. It's a hard science objective thing. He puts the sample, the DNA sample, in the machine, and it just reads the unwinding sequences and rewinding sequences.
I know that Bruce Lipton had difficulty getting it to unwind.
Yeah, he's gone quite a bit further with this. And anyway, with the subtle energy machine that we use, the harmonic translation, we did a similar experiment at the same time. We were measuring the effects of the machine on the DNA, but doing it at a distance simultaneously, while Glenn was doing it with the hard science device. And the end result of this is what we're publishing for the conference, and the results are fairly promising and exciting. But what it demonstrates, minimally, and this is without going into too much detail, it demonstrates clearly that there is a parallel process occurring not only on the physical DNA level, but on the etheric level. There's a very similar process. And whilst there are some distinctive differences, they do, the two systems match fairly nicely. And
let me make sure I understand this. That Vibe machine, it runs up and down till about 80,000 hertz, right?
Yeah, it puts out a complex signal, and it also puts out one hell of a pulse magnetic field, let me tell you. You don't want to get too close to the thing. It's quite a wallop, and it's being used, of course, for helping people to heal. But, obviously, like all his forebears and everything else, Gene wants to know what his machine is doing in detail on the more subtle levels, and certainly with DNA, we have been able to demonstrate an unwinding and rewinding effect with it.
Did he set it to a particular frequency or just run it up and down to that 80,000
hertz? The Vibe does not have has no variability. It's a set waveform. So it doesn't. There's nothing to vary. And the only there is time variance, but that's we didn't use any time variance. We had a standard 30-second zap was used for it.
How did the DNA know to unravel?
Well, the signals from the Vibe were such that it created an unwrapping or unwinding of the DNA.
How much did it unwind, do you know?
Oh, quite a bit. It unwound. It's you'd have to see the numbers and you'd have to consult with Glenn is the one who knows the details about how much that, quantitatively, how much that represents. We got an entirely parallel set of numbers in which we can demonstrate that the DNA winding and unwinding was considerable. And not only that, but the effect on the rewinding, it rewound to a higher level of energy for a considerable length of time.
Interesting. Now, the one that you did...
That's the one I'm talking about. The one on the physical level, it returned to normal, but with the DNA at the etheric level, the energy remained very, very high and has remained high for weeks on end.
How did you test the one on the etheric level? How do you measure that?
It's with a machine here called the harmonic translation system.
Really?
Yes, and that's the system that, in fact, if you remember, I sent you the little DVD, which has failed.
Yeah, I couldn't get it to play, though.
No, we've had trouble. I don't know what's going on with DVDs these days, but a whole batch of them recently have not recorded properly, and we don't understand it. This is coming from the guy who does the major copying, and he's an expert, and he doesn't know what's going on. It's like there's some encryption process on this has gone wrong. I don't know what's happening with it.
Well, do you measure the light, or what are you measuring?
We're measuring the DNA itself. We're measuring the energy, the subtle energy attached to the DNA, because we're using actual DNA samples. So we have the sample of the sample, so to speak, on our equipment here in Louisville, while simultaneously Glenn is doing his work in the lab in New York.
Now, I'm curious, and you may not have this information, I don't know, would the etheric level, would the speed of that frequency be higher than the one that he measures that's in the physical body?
It's totally different. There are direct parallels in the measurement of the winding and unwinding process. They have some very close parallels, but the type of energy that you're measuring is of a different order. And you then get back into your philosophy and your thinking about it and how you look at it. It's a fairly complex business. And in order, you know, this is an infant science because this is one of the first, I mean, it's not the only thing, but it's one of the very rare times that anybody has taken the time or trouble to do a proper experiment that parallels the physical DNA experiment that's actually being done right as we speak. So it is a very interesting set of results here.
It happens to be something I'm kind of obsessed with, so please forgive me if I sound like an idiot because I don't have the right vocabulary to ask these questions. But,
you've got to ask more because we got something bigger and more fascinating even than that coming up at the conference. It's an absolute first.
Can you tell us?
Yes, I will. And I'm not trying to put you off the DNA because obviously it's a very important report that we're going to be making. The paper on that should raise a few eyebrows. But let me tell you about one of the big things that's happening that is brand new and I believe very, very important in the field of the paranormal and, as you will see, probably for the entire planet. I'll give you a little bit of background. The gentleman who is doing the work, his name is Dave Farnsworth. And he's an inventor. You probably, most people know the word television, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a great number of people know the American inventor of television, whose name was Philo Farnsworth.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. Well, Dave is the grandnephew of Philo Farnsworth, and it looks like a lot of his inventiveness has rubbed off on Dave. Well, he has some interesting, you know, other stuff, which I'm not going to go into, but he's had some really intriguing stuff that he's patented and done. But the big thing that he has done, and this is the part that is going to be very interesting, is that, and I've seen this myself, this is not something I'm speculating about, he has taken a spectrum analyzer, and there's only a handful of companies that make high-grade spectrum analyzers, so the one that he's using is manufactured by a company called Tektronix, and he took that unit, has modified the software and considerably, and has created antennae, which he can hook into it, and when you turn this on, instead of just getting typical, electromagnetic wave forms, if you like, frequencies on different levels, which is very much what it's for, you now, with this new and system, you can actually see directly into the etheric field. Yes, and you can get, you can see images of faces of people, sometimes animals, sometimes symbolic numbers, all kinds of stuff showing up. Most amazing thing, and it comes up constantly.
And if we just turn it on and whatever happens to be around shows up?
Yes, in some cases there's a lot of stuff around, some cases not very much. They did it at my office one weekend, and they put the ring over me, and a whole bunch of stuff showed up. And somebody else, it may not show as much of initially. You can go to a place which is, very well known for being full of atmosphere, and it may show a ton of stuff. So, in fact, it happened at a very famous venue down in St. Augustine, Florida, recently, and they picked up a bunch of material on the thing, and the engineers for this company had never seen anything real like this coming off the street, so to speak. They were just blown away. And sometimes it will produce, you know, images of somebody who might have been involved with the place will show up, and they had one show up at that venue in Florida recently. The material is a little bit proprietary in that it's going into a patent process. So certain things I cannot speak about, and certain things I don't know because I'm not privy to the patent process. But I am involved in helping them to do. To have this talk, I will be presenting, Dave, and he will probably be doing a live demonstration at Loxman.
What is it presenting? Is it the hologram?
Well, they're not holograms. No, these are images of...
I mean, is it the holographic environment, the information that's encoded in the frequencies that we can't see?
Yes, in a sense it is. It's, you can define it that way, if you wish. I think that the... What they're talking about, the company that's presenting it is called Etheric Encounters. And actually, you can see that on the web. It's just called Etheric Encounters. Type it in, and you'll get a little teeny bit of information on it. But those images are visible on the screens, and they're not controllable. It's not like an artifact. You're not making it happen.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't know who's going to show up or what's going to show up.
That's amazing.
Yeah, sometimes you see animal pictures, too, of dead animals or etheric fields. So, and it goes into the etheric to apparently quite a degree. Quite a degree. And it looks like the little bit I know of it, I think this is going to go further in the dimensions than they've even thought. So I have a sense, and just from some of the stuff I know already, that this may be moving in and out of different etheric dimensions.
I'm going to have to ask a question now. Because one of the questions, I've been posing a set of 20 questions to some of the leading thinkers in the world, you know, focusing on consciousness and things like that. And one of them is, what is your opinion on the topic of entities? And even Bill Rowell, who, you know, spent his life studying it, said, I don't have any proof that they exist.
Yeah, but Bill's a little bit of a physicalist with that stuff, I think.
Yes, so I was looking for science about it. So I guess this right here.
In one sense, this is a major, major breakthrough. It's going to remove some of the question marks, I think, once and for all, because number one, it's a repeatable event. Now, it's not simplistically replicable because I can't go along and say, yeah, I want a picture of my grandmother every time, although that may be possible one day. But what is going to happen is you're going to get constant imagery. And some of the images are going to need to be enhanced and blown up. Some of them are very clear. You can see them immediately. And it's really a very surprising thing to watch this stuff. So
I'd love to see that.
Yeah, well, at this point, it's a drive out to Loxland. But
do you suppose that you know, people that say, like, for example, there's a man here at Bowser's in Atlanta that says that he sees entities attached to people.
Yes,
and that they're messing up their lives. Do you think that with this thing you could actually see that?
Yeah, oh yes, Dad, and you'll see some things that you don't want to see with this too.
Like what?
Sometimes the imagery is very, very ugly.
Really?
Yes.
You mean, like,
you know,
give us an example.
If you look at it from the point of view of reflecting a quality of an individual, some of it's very pretty and some of it isn't so pretty.
Is it just like what you would imagine a terrible emotion to look like? Is that what it is?
Well, it could be, you know, if you want to see my soul in its naked aspect, you might want to look at some of this stuff. it's along those lines. I mean, we know that thoughts and energies distort ourselves very simply, very easily. And those of us who are hypersensitive to things around us can sometimes see distortion when there's no apparent physical distortion. And that's what I would say. And I mean, I know that Dave has one viewpoint, I have another. I just reserve my judgment based on years of thinking about these things, and I've been very deeply involved in paranormal experience, so I don't like to come out with a hard and fast rule about it. What I would say is that there are some souls that are pretty miserable and others that are much happier.
That's just amazing.
Yes, but it isn't all uniformly, you know, one group. Believe me, it's not. It's quite a variety of experience with this stuff. And
do you see the people the way they presented?
Well, you see images. They scroll past fairly rapidly, and you've got to go and isolate them again. So you're going to see aspects. Now, down at St. Augustine at the Ripley's Museum, they saw, like, one woman showed three times, but in three different aspects. And finally somebody said, oh, that's Ruth. And so Dave apparently said, well, who's Ruth? And they said, well, she was one of the founding people, or I don't want to quote that because I know she was an important party in the past. And apparently there was a picture of her on the wall, so they were able to verify that that was Ruth.
That's just amazing.
Well, that's why I told you, this is to me, this is one of the most important breakthroughs that has been for many, many years. And I know of other very important things in the world that have happened that have been tremendously important. But this is like the TV breakthrough, because it's a replicable system in the sense that you can set it up and somebody else can operate. You can just walk away from it, and it's still going to keep operating.
That's
depending on the you can put the ring around the person, you can aim the ring at the sky, you can take it outside. I know outside my office we got different images from what we got inside my office.
So it's just like they're all floating around.
I mean, sometimes the etheric stuff is very close on hand, and other times it's not so. It depends, I think, on the individual as well as to what you're measuring. But some people have very strong reactions with it. It's an infant science.
Glad you told me. And I have to tell you, if it weren't you telling me this, I don't know if I'd believe it.
Well, you have to see it to believe it.
Amazing. Yep. So I heard this story the other day about Norm Shealy getting this black box from Russia and dialing in some kind of frequency with Caroline Mace, and suddenly it says, you called, I'm here, I'm Genesis. And Norm was like, no, I didn't call anybody. And he said, well, that's my number, and you put my frequency, and so here I am. So does it appear that maybe one day you can put in some frequency in this thing and speak to your grandma?
I think it's more likely to be the other way around. I seriously doubt, with our knowledge of things, that the etheric field is even faintly controllable or encompassable. It's so vast. I mean, it makes the physical universe look like an absolute beginner. I don't know if it'll... I think it'll be more like the other way around. They will be able to contact us much more readily and easily.
Is this something he's going to be able to put out on the market at some kind of reasonable price?
Well, at this point in time, the answer is definitely not. It will eventually be marketed by certain groups. The units are not... These analyzers are extremely expensive to begin with. It's not a thing for, you know, a rank amateur, because the cost of the units... I think they're going to be, you know, at least $250,000 each.
What kind of frequency? Are y'all measuring the frequencies that exist when these things appear?
I can't give you that information for two reasons. Number one, I don't know them, but number two, the way he's modified this stuff, not even the engineers at Tektronix can figure it out, and he ain't going to reveal anything because it is patent. It's going into a patent process, and therefore the numbers will be completely proprietary at this point and probably for the immediate foreseeable future. But the point about this stuff is what you can do with it.
Yeah. Well, to me, because I'm about to start doing some research with Carl Merrick, because I hear numbers in my head, like real specific numbers to the point 100.
Yeah.
And I think with something like that, if we can eventually test the frequency of the field around our individual physical bodies, if we get the right area where the speed of light, you know, that resides within us, I think that if we get those numbers, we could predict disease for maybe 10 years in the future.
Yes, I think there's many things planned for this little whiz-bang machine. So right now it's in the early stage, and of course they're seeking significant funding to get the thing further off the ground. But right at this moment, the most important part of it is the getting ready for the television shows so that it can generate interest and also feedback some capital to make, you know, further research possible.
Because well, let's take a minute.
It's going to need a lot of work on it. I mean, there's a long way to go. I could see 101 things that can be done with this.
It's amazing.
Yeah,
it really is amazing.
But I mean, it's a little screen, so you know, you're looking at this thing, and suddenly, good Lord, there's a face. It looks like an Egyptian woman or something, you know. And then you'll see something else. And sometimes they're little teeny faces. Sometimes they're quite big.
Amazing.
Yes, it truly is amazing.
Well, I could ask you another 1,000 questions, but I want to talk about some of the stuff you're doing, for example, the healing work that you do with radionics. People don't believe it, and I know it's real, so I want you to give them some of your examples so they'll believe us.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Camille.
Right. Well, the sad part for me on Camille is that you didn't get to see the little DVD disc.
Well, maybe you can send me another one that works.
Yeah, well, we got to get it to work. But anyway, Camille is a young lady who's about close to 9, and when we met her, I didn't really meet her first. I met her dad, who is an MD, is an internist. Her mom is a community mental health specialist. I think she's got an MA in something. So they're both very, very much involved in health and well-being. And it's their first child. And she was born with a condition called microcephaly, which is a fancy term for having a small head. And actually, it's usually known as microencephaly and microcephaly. They're sort of almost interchangeable terms. And what that means is that the child has a small brain and a small head.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not... I mean, you wouldn't have said by looking at her, you'd know that, but she had a slightly smaller than average, and the net effect was that she couldn't walk, talk, feed herself, or do anything. She was essentially the victim of this particular form of congenital disorder, and there is no specific therapy that can be given to help them because they normally just recommend a sort of physical therapy to keep their limbs moving and so on, but there's nothing of great importance. So there are different types of microcephaly, and there are some children who were able to walk and stuff, but she had one of the more severe types, and the typical life expectation is about 8 to 9, and they normally die of a major infection because they have terrible, you know, dystonia and stuff, and they really can't do much. Well, we started working with her 3 and 3/4 years ago using the harmonic translation system in order to design informational, bioactive informational programs that could be delivered on videotape, and that has been the bulk of her primary therapy. The parents have taken her to you know, the two various groups who do, you know, some alternative work, and to try to help the brain, but they never got any really significant changes. They got very small changes, but nothing of enormous significance, except doing some detox work.
Mm-hmm.
They did have some slight improvements. But with the harmonic translation system and the work that we've been able to do, she now is up and running, almost literally. She feeds herself. She has had the generation, I can't call it restoration of it, we don't believe she ever had it. She has now got what we'd call normal peripheral vision. Her cognitive skills have improved dramatically. She's actually had an increase in the size of her cranium in her seventh year, which does not normally happen. Anybody who knows medicine knows that that's typically, you don't ever hear reports of the cranium getting larger after the second year. If after the first, it's pretty, it's not usual to see the head expand, but the head has expanded, the brain has. She can do things today that she was never able to do. She's made absolutely dramatic progress. Her muscles, she has great muscle strength where she had virtually nothing. There's 101 little things, and we've sort of captured this on our little DVD, which sadly you didn't get to see. But she's one of a group of children that we work with who are severely compromised by different forms of disorder, including autism. And we've worked with, you know, central auditory processing and many different types of brain damage. And we find that these technologies that we're using can have tremendous effect on helping otherwise hopeless children.
Now, what did you do for her, Peter?
Well, what we do is, we have some unusual methods of getting, we have to detect or find the medicines that are appropriate. These are then encoded in a very special technique inside the computer system. So the medicines are what are called bioactive information. And so to the viewer, they're just patterns of light and sound. There's really nothing exciting about them. They're, kids like them because they're kind of moving light. Shapes and colors, sounds come out of it. But there's really nothing terribly exciting. It's just a fairly boring procedure. But the encoding process allows the medicine, the active part of it, to be delivered to the cells in the body. And the body just gets the information as if it had a dose of real medicine.
And is this something that you did at a distance?
It can be done at a distance. Some cases can only be done at a distance for a number of reasons, and sometimes that's all we do.
What exactly did you do?
Well, we had to do, first of all, a very detailed, in-depth analysis, and that's done by the information from the child is, where, again, that's a radionic technique, if you like, in which you take the information at a distance and you do a very precise analysis of all the imbalances that exist in the physical and non-physical bodies. If you don't believe in non-physical bodies, then you would say we're practicing total stupidity, but we're not. We're doing something that is vital for a complete understanding of what went wrong. And then when we know what went wrong, then we can try to give corrective information to put what went wrong right. And it's the attempt that we make in our work to do this.
Now, is it done with the machine?
It's done with the harmonic translation system.
And for the people that don't know, where can they find you and see this?
Well, the easiest way to take a very simple, very brief look at what we're doing would be on my website. That's holistic-alt.com. Just holistic and then a little dash and then alt.com. Mm-hmm. Our telephone is 502 5024231188. That's 5024231188. And as I said, our work is considered experimental. We make no promises and we tell no lies. And whatever happens to take place is fine. In some cases, the results are very evident fairly quickly in some cases, mm-hmm. sometimes very quickly. In other cases, not so. It can take a long time before you see what we would call appreciable results.
Well, you're using subtle energy, so I would imagine that times it can take subtle time to change it.
It can. It all depends on the rate at which it enters into the cell equation. And once you can get that in, with this kid, it has been fairly rapid. And in some other cases, we work right now with a little girl who's got Rett's syndrome. It's a pretty drastic condition. She's about 16, and she essentially disappeared from normal growth and well-being when she was about 15 months old. So she, she can stand up and walk in a strange way from side to side, but has to be monitored and taken care of, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Sweet kid. But, now for the first time, we've worked with her for about a year and a quarter. She's beginning to focus her attention very carefully on things and is much more aware, to the point now where she is trying to talk. She's actually made some sounds.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, she'll say a sound like when the mom takes her to the bathroom for a bath, she'll say, bah, which she's never done before. And
it's almost like you're tuning her consciousness or something.
Well, you're doing more than that. You're working with a lot of the raw material in the brain. You're working with the connections. You're working with higher levels of the energetic system, all the way from, the physical aspects all the way into the higher level bodies, such as the, what they call in the old-fashioned terms, the monad, atmic, and buddhic. So we believe the human being has about 6 or 7 major layers to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And by operating on these different layers, we are sometimes able to do some rather interesting things.
Have you found that some particular things respond particularly well, particular illnesses, for example?
Not necessarily. It seems to cover a wide range. We've had effects all the way from purely physical diseases to all the way up to, horrible psychological disorders, including things that are largely intractable. We've had, for instance, there's a man in England who was in end-stage acute myeloblastic leukemia, which, if anybody knows the leukemia, that's one of the more dangerous ones.
Mm-hmm.
It is not the most rapid of them, but it normally they don't live permanently. They can't get out of it, and he was already into his last year, his third year of life. He was doing chemo and blood transfusions. And at the hospital, they gave him a double dose of chemotherapy by accident, and he decided that was enough for him, and he quit all medical treatments, knowing that he was going to die. And he figured, well, why not try something else? And he found our top practitioner in England who worked with him every month. He'd give him a new medicine tape once a month, and this chap would watch it. And by October of 1998, he was in total remission.
Really?
Yes, total remission. And he stayed there. And in 2002, he was so curious as to what had happened that he went back to the same hospital where they'd managed to almost kill him and said, can you do a complete advanced checkup on me? I want to know what happened to my cancer and if I've got any evidence of anything wrong and so on. And they couldn't find that he'd ever had any, even though they obviously knew he'd had.
Mm-hmm.
And they told him that nobody'd ever lived longer than that they could find in the world from their searching, longer than 3 years from diagnosis. And he was quite hale and hearty. He's still alive, so He's survived now from 98 to 2006. And that is most unusual.
Well, you have, I'm telling you, you have certainly given us some new information that I've not heard about.
No,
and I've heard a lot. I mean, this has been great. Thank you.
You're more than welcome. We do have some other fun things, too.
I want you to come back.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Any time it would be enjoyable for you, it would be enjoyable for me, too.
As you just have a lot of amazing information, Peter. Thank you for sharing it. Now, tell everybody, do you have any books or anything if somebody wants to read about you?
Not so much personally. We do have Energetic Processes. There's two volumes of it. It's in Ex Libris, X-L-I-B-R-I-S. You can get that on the web. It's published on demand. And because I'm the head of the USPA, my name is on the front because I've got an article in each of the volumes. There's two volumes. And I have some private papers that were published on things like cancer cases and stuff that I've worked with. So, but they're not really, you know, books or anything. They're just a few little things.
Are they on the internet for people?
No,
I
do not. Not in the United States. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, I understand.
Your
parents, I'm sure, aren't real accepting of this in the science world.
Well,
are they?
You have to be careful how you present. I don't mind sharing information with people, but even my peer-reviewed article, I'm glad I have it because, I'll put it this way, the record from that lady who had a brain tumor in Louisville, who's one of the rarest of the rare recoveries using alternatives, they altered the records recently.
Are you serious?
No, I'm not. I'm deadly serious. And if I had a lot of money and nothing else to do, I would tear the establishment apart and demonstrate the horror story of doing that to a poor person.
It's time for science to wake up.
Yeah.
It is time for them to wake up.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.